Good morning. Now, what Matt didn't tell you is that if you noticed, I was at the University of Missouri back at the time when he was an undergraduate. So if any of you need some stories on him, just see me when we get done and we might can come up with a few. No, in all seriousness, we had some good times there together. Matt was involved in collecting some research data and various other things. He's a valuable asset to your organization. I asked Bill Bowman as I was putting this together, to give me a list of things that he thought you might be interested in getting a little bit further insight to. And so that's what I've attempted to do. I hope I've come close to hitting the mark. If not, my apologies. Give you a little bit of maybe introduction and background to some of the things that have evolved in the pork industry over time. I grew up down in southwest Georgia on a farming operation, and as I was finishing up high school in the early and mid-80s, there was still quite a bit of fair-to-finish operations down there. Small operations, 200-300 sows, that was a big operation at that point. Those paid a lot of bills, put a lot of kids through college. There was a local place to harvest and slaughter those pigs and market them, and that's changed a lot, as you can imagine, over the last 10, 15, 20 years. Really along through that same period of time, and contract production really began to take hold, particularly in North Carolina. Wendell Murphy was a huge part of that. And if any of you have ever read a little bit about him and how his business developed, it's quite an amazing story. But as those businesses grew and the contract hog production model took hold, those other operations really began to migrate north quite a bit. And really today, down where I grew up, there's a very limited amount of pork production. So that industry has changed and evolved and matured quite a bit, and I still think there's probably some room for that to happen quite a bit. I tell you from a personal standpoint, my guess is why that happened is that a lot of those businesses down where I grew up and my family was involved in some of those, there was opportunity left on the table. And we probably weren't as efficient as we needed to be. Somebody else had the foresight to say, hey, there is opportunity there, and they took that and made that into a phenomenal business. This list really gives you a snapshot of hog production today, accounting for a fair chunk of the sow production in the U.S. These are the major players today that account for live hog production in the U.S. A number of those names you'll recognize. To give you a little bit closer look at our business, Smithfield Foods, and our hog production group, which is the part that I work closely with, that business entity is Murphy Brown LLC. We have today about 1.1 million sows here in the U.S. That makes up about 18% of the U.S. sow herd. We've scaled that back here recently over the last bit of time. When you look at the slaughter side of the business, some names you probably recognize there are really three primary hog kills. Smithfield Packing Company, based on the East Coast, Farmland Foods in the Midwest, and John Morrell. You'll notice that we harvest and slaughter quite a bit more pigs than we actually produce. We do purchase pigs out on the open market, and we also do market hogs out of this production system to other external packers. But for the most part, it's a fairly integrated business, where a bulk of the hog production is in that contract model. We don't have a large lion's share of company-owned farms in the production system. A good chunk of it is contract production. Internationally, we have a presence. We have a couple of joint venture businesses in Mexico involved in hog production, and Europe is probably the next frontier that we're going to focus on in terms of expansion. A little bit about the group that I'm involved with more specifically and what we do on a daily basis. As part of Smithfield Foods, our small division is Smithfield Premium Genetics Group. And basically our focus and mission is very, very simple, very straightforward. We are the internal genetics provider to our production pyramid. And we're charged with providing the highest quality genetic inputs at the lowest cost possible to the system. Very straightforward. By whatever means it takes to do that. We're really a small group of people within the organization. We have half a dozen geneticists with postgraduate training, a handful of people involved in computing and database type of activities that are very skilled in what they do. And then, of course, the farm staffs that run our production operations at the genetic nucleus level, which doesn't encompass a lot of farms. Across our business, we have numerous other people with various technical expertise, including reproductive physiologists, meat scientists, quite a few veterinarians across the country that work with our hog production group. So, to kind of giving you a little bit of an idea of our business, try and give you some sort of feeling for how we challenge ourselves within our technical group as we look forward as to what the competition might be. And this is certainly a bit far-fetched. I read about this here over the last bit of time, and in a sense, it's silly. I certainly don't think this is going to be how meat production take shape. But as you sit back and be a little bit open-minded and think about this, there's actually a fairly decent list of bullet items that make this sort of thing actually somewhat appealing to some probably small group of people. And that list of bullet items are things that we deal with on a daily basis that are challenges to our businesses. They're challenges to your businesses as well. First of all, animal welfare. And here, if you can't read that, what this is a proof of concept that's actually already come forward about growing meat in a petri dish, taking the animal out of production and actually growing that in a laboratory type of process. Okay? Again, very far-fetched, but it raises some interesting issues. Here are the things that we get around and make that fairly appealing. Animal welfare. That's something that I can tell you that we in our business take extremely seriously. From all the way from how we train our staff, we design facilities, and try and be sure we're caring for the animals appropriately. That becomes removed from the process if you look at this type of technology. The cattle side of livestock production, poultry and swine, also a continual issue for us is the environment. We're not perceived as being very friendly to the environment. This, of course, takes that out of play as well. Disease, from a food safety standpoint, this has advantages. Disease from how we raise our animals. That's, as some of the slides you saw in Dr. Lawrence's presentation, that can certainly cause a problem for us in terms of animal production. Production efficiency, I'm going to talk a little bit more about that later, and it's already been brought up. This is a huge issue and a big challenge for us going forward as businesses. And this may be the biggest one of all. You can do lots of things with this type of product. I just want to raise this, I think we need to challenge ourselves to be very open-minded as we go forward over this next few years as to what the opportunities might be. Just a very quick skeleton of the things I want to cover here over the next half hour or so. I'm going to focus in some detail on a few of those. Bill asked if I would give you some insight into terms of how we collect information, the types of information we collect, the ways we go about collecting it, and how we deal with things on a genetic improvement basis. So I am going to give you a little bit of detail as to how we do things, and these are the things that I want to skim through. From a commercial production system all the way back up to genetic improvement, this is really our model. And it's that typical old swine genetic improvement pyramid that probably many of you have seen, which really flows genes down from a nucleus of purebred herd down through multiplication of a female down to a commercial pig. And really the reason for this is implementing the science that we know. The whole focus here is to pull out as much heterosis and hybrid vigor in animal production to improve those production efficiencies as well as possible. So if you start with our commercial pig, and this is not unique to our business, this would be pretty much across all of pork production. Most of pork production produces a pig that has 100% heterosis. The sire basically is unrelated to the commercial sow that produced that pig. And the primary emphasis there is to pick up hybrid vigor and growth and throughput type of traits. And also, we know that pig grows more robustly. It has less treatments. It handles challenges much better. No different than a feedlot steer would in that same scenario. Kind of moving back on up the pyramid, pretty much everyone uses an F1 sow. Again, all that means is that the parent, the two parents, the sire and dam that produced that commercial sow, were unrelated. These happen to be two maternal lines, two purebred lines that are mated to produce that commercial parent sow that predominates our commercial sow production base. Moving back on up, the purebred production, very, very limited in terms of numbers, but that's the place where we have to do all the various purebred matings to flow on down through the system. To kind of give you an idea of the type of numbers it takes to make this work, if you're looking at 100,000 sows of commercial production, you need about 10,000 sows in multiplication and at the nucleus level to make all that flow down through. Utilization of heterosis and crossbreeding, why do we do it? I'm not going to attempt to go through these numbers, but very much like it is in beef cattle, swine is exactly the same. We know that heterosis has a huge impact on how we do things. I remember getting told in undergraduate animal genetics classes is that heterosis is really the only free ride that we get. It's not quite a free ride because with any improvement in production output, there's some added inputs that come with it, but it does come with a marginal benefit. It's very straightforward, and I guess I struggle with sometimes, I know in beef, from the commercial side, it's no secret, the U.S. cow herd is certainly getting blacker and has been for a period of time as to why that really happens. To kind of give you an idea in our system, the impact that it has, I pulled some better performing farms out of our multiplication system and out of our commercial system and pulled out, use one metric, pigs weaned per sow per year. That really is a trait that kind of for us rolls up production efficiency. And I think of it very similar to like pounds weaned per cow exposed. Really a similar type of thing. In pigs weaned per sow per year, it captures how many pigs she had, how well she raised them, how well the pigs lived through the pre-weaning phase, fertility of the sow itself, how many non-productive days she had. We want to minimize that. Rolls it all up into one number. And you look at that, heterosis is worth, really, this is a purebred sow here versus a crossbred, is worth 3 to 4 pigs per sow per year, which ends up being a big number in terms of total pounds produced on a sow basis. Went back to some of my old beef data and pulled from the literature just to remind this group that it's also important in beef cattle. This is some information that published in 94 by Davis and others. Tried to apply some production efficiency and heterosis together, rolling it up into net return. And really, when you look at that, it's around $70 net profit per cow exposed. That rolls up a lot of traits. Really centered around the cow, really centered around reproduction. This actually is some simulation work that I pulled together back when I was at the University of Missouri, really just reinforcing the previous slide. My thoughts on heterosis, whether it's cattle or hogs, are really about the same. I can't come up with any good reason not to implement it at all, particularly when we are in low-margin businesses. We have to gain every advantage we have. So I still struggle to come up with, from a commercial production standpoint, why we wouldn't do that. Another area that we're routinely involved with in terms of genetic improvement is identifying the right breeds and lines that we should be using in our production system. And coming from cattle, this is a little bit different than I think how we typically do things in beef. We certainly know that not all breeds do everything very well. They have strengths and weaknesses, much like it is in beef, same way in pigs. Another realization that we've come to in a lot of the trials that we've done, there's certainly no perfect pig. If they grow well, they usually don't do something else quite as well as we would like them to. If they have superior meat quality, we usually give something else up as a trade-off. And so we're constantly in search of other inputs into the system globally that can allow us to further our genetic improvement. Something else that that we certainly realize in a lot of these tests, we can select, of course, for any trait that's heritable. And we can move it over time. But if I can find a different genetic line or breed that does that thing better, there's no way I can overcome that step change from inserting another breed into the production system over selection. I would guess that in 2007, our group was probably involved in testing 15 different external genetic lines or breeds. We'll do the same thing as we finish up 08. This is just an example of one trial where we tested a number of different external lines for a handful of traits that are important to us, really centered around growth, efficiency, and meat quality type of traits and lean yield traits. We'll do this very aggressively, and we will test lines from anywhere on the globe. If we can import semen and test it in our production system, we will do that regardless of where they are. And we'll continue to grow this database over time as well. You don't have quite as good of access to those types of trials and information. As I kind of look back historically at the data that you do have access to, the lion's share of it has really been pulled together out at the Meat Animal Research Center, where over time part of their charge and mission has been to continually evaluate and compare different sources of germplasm. But that information still does exist, not very much in a big way. And even within Angus, it would appear to me that there are certainly sources of germplasm outside of North America, across the globe that could be, you know, pulled together in trial to evaluate new sources of germplasm. We continually test and sample breeds. I would guess that we'll attempt to internalize a new genetic line just about every year to insert into our production system. I want to move on to one of the areas that Bill asked that I talk about was the kind of data that we capture, and what is our model for doing that. I tell you today that compared to 6, 7, 8 years ago, it's pretty much a paperless type of system. Probably a lot of the same kinds of transitions that you have gone through as purebred breeders over that same period of time. As we look at our purebred data collection model, it really looks quite a bit like this. And again, this is just at the genetic nucleus level. And I'm going to go through each of those in a little bit more detail. Starting really with the boar stud. We're in a business even at the commercial level today that it's 100% artificial insemination. There's no natural service that goes on anywhere across the business. Now, that's relative to cattle, that's certainly a plus for pigs. I tell you that AI is a more robust process. It's a more user-friendly type of process than AI in beef cattle, and we can have a great deal more success with it. Just from a biological basis, that's just simply the way it is. And it's a disadvantage for beef that AI can't be more broad spread. So I'm going to talk through that just a little bit, talk a little bit about how we gather data in the sow herd itself, in the grow finish section, and even back down at the plant level. Today, all of our database would be based in our technical office there in North Carolina. It all comes in from various portions of the globe on a daily basis. And we communicate, our mode of communication is back out to our farms and our staffs is purely web-based. No paper transactions take place. If we look at the boar stud, how we manage the distribution of semen, very much an automated process. Again, everything in our system is done via artificial insemination. A boar can typically produce 25 to 30 doses per collection. We'll service a sow 2 to 3 times, depending upon where we're at in the business. And we actually track that dose of semen, what farm it goes to, what sow it gets serviced to, and all of it links back together into our database. Much like animal identification, the process is really based on, in this case, a barcode type of system. Every tube of semen, these happen to be little tubes of semen in a processor here as they're being sealed and packaged. Every tube of semen has a barcode label on it. If it's a single sire dose of semen, it has the board's identification, the genetic line on it, when that dose was processed, and the expiration date the last day that it can be used. Again, one boar stud may have a distribution to 20 or 30, 40, maybe even sow farms on a weekly basis, and all of that information gets linked back together into the database management system. Animal identification, today we use, and again, this is just at the genetic level, the genetic farm level, the pure line level, barcodes and RFIDs completely. There's no tattoos in the system. That used to be the a mode of animal, permanent animal identification. We use this process instead today. Very much like exactly same type of RFID tags you can use in cattle. The data collection process, what's nice about this from a genetic improvement standpoint is we really limit the errors that take place due to animal identification. Those are fairly non-existent today versus using a tattoo type of system. Barcode tags. And kind of how we go through this is when every baby piglet is born at the genetic farm level, they receive duplicate tags in each ear. It's a barcode. It has a number associated with it that's unique to our production system. They're tagged fairly immediately when they're processed. What this has helped us with from a genetic improvement standpoint relative to half a dozen years ago is we're able to gather a lot of information on an individual pig at the beginning of the production cycle when it's born. Individual birth weights, weaning weights. If that pig dies anywhere through the process, it's easily recorded and why it died. All of this information is collected via a handheld device that is then communicated real time with back to the central database. The electronic sow identification has also fostered added data collection much more accurately and much more smoothly. We capture all of her reproductive events. A breeding event, for example, there's a handheld device that you scan the her RFID. Remember, you take that tube of semen, you scan in the boar identification on it, and you have an automated accurate linkage of the subsequent litter of pigs that's going to be born in an immediate build of the pedigree. So a very seamless type of system that we utilize. As we go on down through the grow finish type of traits that we collect, very exactly like I would guess yearling weights you would collect, we would gather what we'd call it off-test growth information. Pigs reach around 160, 70 days of age. We'll capture a weight and an ultrasound event. That ultrasound event is associated with lean yield traits, fat depth, a description of muscle, and then also intramuscular fat. This happens to be a snapshot from the software we utilize, Swine Image Analysis Program. I know that you folks are involved quite a bit in gathering ultrasound data. I tell you that this is a this has become a much quicker process for us over the last 3 to 4 years. The technicians, when they gather this information on the pig, they know if they have an accurate image or not, if the image is good versus bad. So they know if that's going to be an image that can yield and add in meaningful information to the database. And then we have a couple of folks back in the office that then go through and screen those images, and then they automatically get dumped into the database for the genetic evaluation process. Feed intake data. At the nucleus farm level, we're able to gather cereal weight and feed intake. Very similar to your GrowSafe type of system that I think probably several of you have seen. can't see this very well, this is a photo of what's called a fire system. Basically, a pig has an RFID in their ear. They go inside this feeding station. They can eat at will. It records every feeding event. When they go in there, they also step on a set of scales, and it pulls that information as well. Generates a lot of information very quickly, and we're trying to use that, obviously, in the genetic improvement process to create a more efficient animal. A couple of comments and observations as we've worked with those data over time, and I think they probably also apply to cattle. I know that this group has an increased interest in feed intake data collection, so just share some observations with you. One of the things that you need to be sensitive to is that what we find in pigs is it doesn't always represent commercial eating conditions. These genetic farms, i.e. purebred farms in which we gather data, they operate at a very elevated health status. They have less diseases rolling through them relative to a commercial situation. And animals just simply respond differently in that type of environment versus a commercial environment. Okay? So it's not always apples to apples. From a selection standpoint, what is it the trait that you're going to select for? Is it residual feed intake? You've probably seen some articles in popular press that have described what this is. Intake, reduced intake itself, or improved efficiency. One thing I'd caution you to be very careful of as you go through the development of this is not selecting for reduced appetite. Biologically, I'd tell you, our experience says that's a bad thing. Animals have to have the desire to eat and grow in more stressful situations. Okay? And I think that's really the kind of take home from that. If you do this, and on an individual animal basis, efficient genotypes are usually leaner genotypes, and they're more than likely those animals that you saw in the slide in the previous presentation that are having to get treated more in the feedlot. Okay? So from a within breed standpoint, we'll be very careful with that and proceed with caution, I think. electronic data we're gathering on female development. Just a couple of quick slides on that. Just like everything else, the cost of space to develop a female is going up. Anything we can do to get a female into production earlier, i.e. reach puberty earlier, is a good thing. No different than on a growing heifer, age at puberty data is hard to collect accurately in our system. We're trying some things now that may help us in that particular arena, and it's the utilization of the animal's behavior and RFID to try and capture that. Really just kind of show you what this is. This happens to be in one of our nucleus sites, an isolation room, for gilt development. You can't see it really too terribly well, but basically the where the gilts roam are kind of outside these small pens back through here. And then in each of these small pens there's a couple of boars. Okay? When a gilt comes in heat, she wants to go talk to that boar. Go visit him. And so what she does is she roams around here. There's this little hole right here where she can have nose-to-nose contact with that boar. And we're starting to get some of the first initial data on this, and it looks actually fairly promising that these types of data are giving us a fairly good description of when those gilts first come into heat. So our challenge is to be, and this happens to be a picture, here's a couple of boars in this pen, you can see the electronic reader, the idea would be that the gilt would move right up here, and she can have nose-to-nose contact with that boar. Some others in our technical group are just finishing up summarizing that information, and it actually looks pretty reasonable at this point. So we're still very early on in the R&D process with it, but these are the types of things from a data collection standpoint, pulling into a database that we're challenging ourselves with on a routine basis so that we can improve the production efficiency of our downstream operations. Selection itself. Just a few slides about how we go about doing that. We do utilize selection index, a similar type of concept to some of the selection index values you have, I believe the dollar beef value, those sorts of things that the association's been involved with. It's really based off a very simple profit equation, revenue minus cost. How do we go about doing that? First, we have to have a good understanding of those, and we generally do. We then take both of these areas and then break them down, or what are the traits that affect this and affect this, okay? Or traits that very closely affect them, that are very related to them. We then compute an EPD for each of those traits. We then come up with what are the appropriate economic values for each of those traits. We roll them together algebraically, and we end up with a single value for each pig, depending upon if it's a terminal line or a maternal line. And we select on one number, that profit value, that selection index value. And it is in monetary units. We know that pig A should have a 10 cent greater return than pig B. And that's really the simplest, a very simple approach. Again, very much like some of the things that you're exposed to in your current genetic evaluation programs. We also try and be sure that we do this on a commercial expression basis within our system. Again, I think I've mentioned one time that the production traits and expression we see in the purebred setting aren't always one-to-one as to what we see in the commercial setting. We compute EPD for a very large number, I guess, of various traits that go into that selection index, depending upon what line it is, if it's a terminal line or if it's a maternal line. We take all of that database. We do it once a week. Data comes in every day, once a week, usually associated around the weekend. Our technical group runs some processes that pull all those data together in a very usable format. It goes through the genetic, the BLUC programs to generate the EPDs. It pulls together the selection indices, and then it's published right back out to our web so that everybody back out at the farms can then utilize that in the selection process. Another couple of words about commercial performance versus purebred performance. Really, genotype by environment interaction from an academic standpoint. The question that we have to answer in the selection process, and think about a terminal boar, do two sires rank the same, or do their offspring perform the same, rank the same, in two different production systems? Maybe I have a production system where pigs finish at around 2 pounds a day. Maybe I have one where they finish at 1.6. Do boar A and B, do they both rank the same in each of those? All that trial data we do with testing different external lines and gathering a lot of commercial data says that answer is probably not. There's kind of they do, but it's not perfect. We're leaving a lot of opportunity on the table due to this interaction that takes place. And when it comes to these commercial traits, average daily gain really primarily is one of the big ones that we're interested in. It's back to those things that affect appetite. The desire for that animal to eat and grow when it gets hot, when it gets cold, when there's more animal density, whatever the case may be that's causing them to have the desire to eat. Those are the things that we're interested in. If we don't do this correctly, we end up selecting the wrong animals. This happens to be some data generated from two commercial farms where we actually know the pedigree of each commercial pig. Very typical situation, production situation in our East Coast operations. And these smooth lines are actually weather station data pulled locally. And these dips through here indicate a temperature and humidity index that's more stressful, obviously, in the warmer months of the year. It's better in the cooler months and goes down. And what you notice is that this solid line with the dots on it, that's actually age-adjusted hot carcass weight from those farms. Falls exactly right in line with that animal stress of a more uncomfortable environment to eat in. Okay? Just one example of those sorts of things. We wanted to ask ourselves in this situation, since we had sires represented throughout this period of time, the same boars, are these boars that, even in this low period of time, the better performing offspring from boars here, are they the same ones here? And the answer is really, I think, is a little bit interesting. A couple of things we learned from this. When it got hotter, not as much a desire there for the animal to eat, we had a greater expression of genetic variation. Okay? Heritability of growth actually increased. when animal stressors were more greatly in place, versus when conditions were optimal for eating. The other thing that we learned, and these are genetic correlations, we kind of broke growth up and defined it as either in a hot, warm, or cold type of environment. And take for whatever that's worth, cold is not really cold in North Carolina. What this said is that when we were in those environmental extremes, is that those high-growth sires didn't rank the same at all. It was basically a random reassortment. Okay? There isn't a lot of G by E data available in beef cattle. Okay? There's a little bit, but there's not a lot. There's certainly some classic work that's been done, but not a lot in recent times. And you're pretty much limited to field data in terms of how you deal with that. Just throw that out there as something for you to consider. Again, as you look to incorporating feed intake and feed efficiency through the process. How do we deal with that? What do we do about it? Today, as part of our genetic improvement process, okay, talked about we gather purebred data at Nucleus Farms. We also gather it in those multiplication farms. Because it's an integrated system, we have the opportunity to capture a lot of data in the commercial production system and at the packing plants and link all of it together. We gather probably around 100,000 records a year on pedigreed pigs that are raised in commercial normal type of conditions. And the idea behind that is to get around the things that we saw in the previous couple of slides. Okay? So what we do is we identify those pigs as they're born in commercial operations. They've been produced by a known sire. We then catch those data as they come through one of those packing plants. They're a part of our business. Those data might get collected, what's today, Tuesday. My group will have a file tonight of those IDs. We know the birth date, mom and dad of that particular pig. We know how much that carcass was when it came through that farmland plant or the Smithfield packing plant. We know the percent lean associated with that pig. We might know some meat quality information. It's going to go immediately into the database and be used in the genetic evaluation program. Okay? These are actually Nucleus level sires that we're using. So we have that information available just as soon as their purebred full brothers come off test and are available for selection. This happens to be a graph gives you an idea by week the number of different sires that we're testing. You can't see that very well, but it's a fairly sizable number that we're pulling data from across the production system. This isn't a new and novel idea. It's been used now for a fair bit of time in poultry breeding by a couple of the larger genetic retail genetic companies. It's a big part of our system. This graph, just be sure I don't run short on time, gives you an idea of the impact that it has on our system. This happens to be age-adjusted commercial carcass weight going from lower to higher, so this is low growth to high growth. This is days to market on data gathered out of our Nucleus High Health system. We want to go lower days to market, so here down to here is low growth to high growth. If it was perfect, there'd be a straight line. These dots indicate sire family information that's represented in both those data. And what you see here is that these are the animals that we're interested in down here. But however, if we'd been collecting only purebred type of data, okay, we would have missed these animals up here. They would have said they're average or below average growth in a purebred scenario. But for whatever reason, this is really a robust growing type of pig. Okay? Conversely, the same sort of thing here. Has what we do had a genetic impact on the commercial system? We are routinely trying to verify that. That's not always easily done, by the way. We do try and measure ourselves at the commercial level and be sure what we're doing translates to trait improvement. We monitor genetic trends of our various lines. We monitor the production across our system. This happens to be a graph looking at improved pork production efficiency, pounds of pork produced per breeding female over the last 20 years. It was actually on a slide in the previous presentation. This does include imports, so it's not exactly apples to apples to that graph, but it's doubled over the last 20 years. So part of that's genetics. I'd say a fair chunk of that also is improvement of how we've run our business as well and how we manage our operations. We challenge ourselves to some targets every year on how much we improve selection index. One of those targets for a terminal line might be, say, we're going to improve our genetic index for one of our terminal lines 70 cents a pig. We take that very seriously because it directly affects the bottom line of our P&L. If we can do that across just the sows that we manage, 70 cents a pig from a boar standpoint, that's worth roughly about $14 million to us, okay? Based on the number of sows that get bred to that genetic improvement and the number of pigs that they produce, that's a fairly substantial improvement. So conversely, if we make the wrong decisions, we can take that to a negative, and that's obviously a bad deal. Bill asked if I'd make a couple of comments about our experiences with molecular genetics. We have been involved to some degree in this area in terms of evaluating it for genetic improvement. You're going to hear a whole lot more, I think, a little bit later today on the status of the technology. But I'm just going to share with you our experience. As you look across the government and academic funding that is available in livestock genetic improvement today, 99% of it has gone to molecular genetics. Very little of it has gone to, I'd say, more population genetics, quantitative genetics sort of improvement. We've been involved with various providers looking at different technologies. I tell you today, we haven't seen anywhere where it's going to improve our bottom line from a genetic improvement standpoint. We like to believe that we've been exposed to the most cutting-edge molecular genetics that are available, those technologies to incorporate into our productions. And I'm talking about traits that, like throughput, efficiency, reproductive traits. We haven't been able to see those advantages yet. There are a few exceptions in genetic improvement. Really in pork centered around meat quality, a couple of single gene type of effects where the mutations were known, they have had big impacts. Those actually still get fairly continuously tested for. Okay? So there has been a couple of successes in that area. Just a couple of observations on things that we see. Retail genetics companies, that's not what we are, but we do visit with a number of those people. We have seen them shift away their research and development, probably a lot of it's due to cost here over the last couple of years, away from spending a lot of dollars in that particular area. The bottom line is that the question that we actually ask ourselves, if we're going to spend an extra 50 cents or a dollar a pig, if we push it out across a commercial production system, do we get a return above and beyond that? There's actually, if you went into the scientific literature over the last couple of years, a couple of pretty reasonable pieces of work that you have to have some very tangible, large returns to make that technology work. It very well may be there. There's about to be a better utilization of whole genome sequencing across the pig genome. We may be able to use that and take the next step forward. I would say that from a traditional quantitative genetic improvement standpoint, we actually still have lots of things left to do and learn that we don't know how to deal with. Feed conversion being one of them. Varying genetic models. How do we better utilize larger pieces of information and data? So we still have a lot of work left to do that I think is low-hanging fruit outside of the area of molecular genetics. To wrap up here over the next couple of slides, where are we looking at in terms of genetic improvement? What should we be looking at here over the next really short window of time and going forward? Really around production efficiency is still probably the area, even though there have been great strides made there. For a lot of the exact same reasons you heard in the previous presentation. I don't think any of these things are going to change. Feed costs are an all-time high. I don't think they're going to pull back necessarily very much. There's I don't think any great reason to believe that they should. Added capital cost. We want to renovate a building today versus 5 years ago. That's a huge increase in terms of doing that. No different from what you see in your operations. Added regulatory. Added regulations to our business. COOL just went into place here a few days ago. None of that's free. Okay? So we have to come up with things to do this better to overcome those added costs to our business. I do think this is going to be a particular important piece to all of us, this access to money. It's been interesting to watch some other livestock publicly traded businesses, see what's happened to them here over the last bit of time. If any of you don't believe that this is an important issue, go look up Pilgrim's Pride and see what's happened with them here over the last 2 weeks. It's very big. I do know on a local farmer ranch type of situation, I do know that this is an issue talking about lending going into next spring. All of those things basically say to us what we can handle biologically outside of those things. We do need to be more efficient in terms of what the type of traits we're selecting for, the type of things that we're trying to do to change the animal to make them more efficient. This is, again, the same type of information from the previous presentation. Looking at the improvement in production efficiency in beef cattle, this happens to be pork. Again, that's been about 100%. This doesn't remove import information. So if you look at beef cattle over the last 20 years, around 36%. Yes, that's an improvement, but you have a lot of opportunity out in front of you to make this look a lot different. I'm going to leave with the last two slides and raise a question that I've started to kick around in my mind. I'm a little bit surprised that it hasn't been asked by the public to this point. If you look at the bar graph to the right, basically it lays out various protein sources and how efficient their caloric intake is in converting that into an energy or protein. Okay? And as beef cattle producers, I mean, we have to acknowledge we're not very efficient. There's not a lot we're going to be able to do about that to change where beef ranks on that. Okay? Pork's more efficient, but it's certainly not very efficient. So the question that I'm wondering with, why hasn't come up? We have a growing world population. Okay? We have increased grain costs that have your margins down to absolutely nothing. I'm a little surprised the consumer hasn't stepped back and said, it costs this to produce a bushel of corn. Okay? We're going to take that and convert that to a pound of protein. What is the most responsible use of that bushel of corn? Is it to feed it to a growing steer or a growing pig? Or is it to feed it more directly to something that's more efficient, very efficient, or use it directly for some sort of more direct human consumption? I think that's going to be a question that possibly comes up more and more, particularly if we continue to head down the same economic climate we've seen develop here over the last couple of years. Last slide. I was in Norway last year and got exposed just a little bit to the salmon industry. And I tell you, I don't know much about it. Still don't. But I walked away with something that absolutely amazed me. And that was how well feed conversion is in salmon production. And I was talking with one of the geneticists. He said, man, we've made huge strides. And I was thinking, well, gosh, from what to what? And I pulled this information. Feed conversion in the early 80s from around 2 down to here in the early 2000s to a little over 1. And actually today, if you ask them what they're converting at, it's right around 1. That absolutely is amazing to me. To produce a pound of protein and your input is equivalent to that. Those are the types of things that I think consumers are going to be looking at, asking questions. Are we using the resources we have at hand in the most responsible way? And I think we, as being involved in the livestock industry, in terms of how we go about our business on a daily basis, need to ask ourselves those same sorts of questions. Thank you. If I can answer any questions on anything covered here today or that I haven't covered, I'd be happy to try and do that.
Dr. Herring, Matt Perrier from Eureka, Kansas. First, commend you for stepping on two issues that are probably near and dear to a lot of our hearts. One, I saw beef, the only less efficient protein producer were sheep, so it's hard for us to hear something like that and hear the crossbreeding word and some of those things at a conference like this, but I appreciate you touching on that. The question I have, you said that now you run your genetic evaluations weekly, is that correct?
That's right, yep.
How often or how more frequent is that than it used to be, and have you seen how much more, I guess, effective is your, or is your genetic progress due to that increased efficiency?
Sure. We could run it on a daily basis today if we wanted to. The primary issue around running an evaluation routinely today, based on today's computing technology that's available, is really when does your data come in? And if you get a lot of data in every day, you probably can run it every day. From a data flow into our system, if we run it once a week, you know, anything beyond that's a marginal benefit. So that's where our decision is at today based on that. I would tell you that if we wanted to run it more frequently a couple of years ago, we couldn't have done it. Two things have changed. Computing hardware has changed, and the software associated with databases that run smoother and quicker in terms of editing the data. And then I'd also say that the software that actually goes through to compute the EPDs, those algorithms have gotten better. Our relationship is very, well, you guys are in the same scenario. We work closely with the University of Georgia Animal Breeding Group. It's just simply from a focus area in this area, in our view, is the elite group out there globally, and they lead the way in this particular area. And that's improved over the last bit of time as well. Can you roll back to them? I don't remember which slide.
I believe it's your second slide. Your second or third slide. There were comments on the right side. Must have been the third slide.
From the end?
No. From the beginning.
Okay. Can somebody roll that one back for me? This one?
No. Go to the next one after that. Right there. Right there.
Those comments right there.
Yeah, I didn't make... This basically is pulled together every year. National Hog Farmer pulls this together. They pull together the top 20 production systems based on sow numbers. You had a question associated with that. Yeah, that's actually a conglomeration of several different businesses that Triumph Foods is. Triumph is a business centered with the plant, new plant in St. Joe.
What percent of the total pork production is produced by these 10 companies?
Can't do the quick math in my head, but I believe that ends up being, in terms of the pig production in the U.S., it's just a little bit south of half on this top 10.
William, one quick question. In terms of the pork and use of technology like ultrasound, is that industry focusing now on improving quality through selection for IMF or marbling as well?
To some extent, depending upon what the food side of the business says that they need. If they need that, I'd tell you that, I mean, we believe the ultrasound technology we have in place today, in fact, we know, we can change that. We can focus on that. If we need a terminal line that has added extra intramuscular fat, we do a number of trials. We did a number of trials to verify its accuracy and use. We do use it in a very small segment to do that. Yeah. Yes, ma'am.
I guess it's not a question as much as a statement. I, as a homemaker, I guess I find the quality of pork not there that it was 20 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
I don't buy pork anymore because
yep.
of the quality. The taste isn't there.
Yep.
It's dry. It's stringy. So all this technology that you're talking about, has it improved your product?
Fair point. I don't disagree with you on the quality aspects. I'm very, very much the same way. A couple of things. One, probably the biggest one, of couple of big things from a change in process standpoint. You know, when I buy chops, I actually buy enhanced pork. It's simply more tender, juicier. The biggest thing that we run into in cooking pork today, and my household is guilty of this, is overcooking it. That's the biggest thing that, from a tenderness standpoint, when we cook it to the appropriate degree of doneness, it actually is a reasonably tender product. You got to remember, the goal of necessarily pork production might not be to produce certified Angus beef. Okay, so relative, you know, put that into the same perspective. It might not be the same breeding objective that's making the trait changes rolling through there. We certainly want it to be a very pleasant eating experience. A lot of pork production today is really centered around further processed foods and not necessarily quite as much around center cut loin production. When we do that, we actually do have lines that do that very well and try and overcome some of the same things that you're talking about. Fair comment.
Thank you, Dr. Harris.
Thank you. Thank you, man.